Ritzy, how are you?
Good, Carmine. How are you?
Good. This is our first time at Building 99 together. This is
the hallowed
house
cool. of Microsoft Research.
Absolutely.
I'm excited.
Me too.
So we are here today with Margaret Burnett. Welcome.
Hi.
And what's interesting is that Margaret actually is with Oregon State University.
Okay.
But she's on loan to Microsoft. Tell us about that.
Okay. So one of the cool things about being a professor is you get to do sabbaticals. And they come roughly every 7 years, so I'm on a sabbatical. And the idea is it's supposed to be a period of rejuvenation where you go off and hang out with people you don't usually hang out with and do something potentially a little bit different than usual or the same but from a different angle. So as part of my sabbatical, I've been spending 3 months here as a visiting researcher and having a wonderful time.
Excellent.
So what have you been working on? Can you talk about it?
Sure. Back home with several of my students, I've been starting some research into how males and females interact with software itself.
Mm.
So there's lots of research already about other things that relate to gender and computer science, like stuff about educational practices and things in the workplace and inclusiveness and all that kind of thing. And all those things are important, but it's not what I'm working on. I'm interested in software itself. With these students, we've in the past found gender differences that pertain to the way men and women interact with spreadsheet software when they're trying to solve spreadsheet-oriented problems. And so I came here trying to figure out how, you know, whether the same phenomena we've seen with spreadsheets extend across other platforms too, like, for example, professional developers and people who use other kinds of software, all within the scope of things that have something to do with some form of software development, from developing spreadsheets to developing professional software to, you know, everything in between.
Wow.
So with a bunch of colleagues here, that's what I've been working on.
That's fascinating. So I have a couple of questions. So you're a professor of?
Computer science.
Computer science.
Yes.
And this arrangement between Oregon State and you and Microsoft, how did that come about? Is this part of an official program or?
No, we don't really have an exchange program. So the way professors usually do sabbaticals is we start thinking about it, 4 or 5 years in advance because we like sabbaticals. And we weigh all the different options about what we could do and who we might be able to hang out with and savor the upcoming experience. And sooner or later, you know, we sort of narrow it down and contact the people at places we'd like to collaborate with and say, well, you know, I'd like to come and visit you. You know, would that be possible? Would you like to work together on this or that or the other? And so I've known a number of people here at both Microsoft and Microsoft Research for a number of years and have interacted with a lot of them informally. And so I contacted them and they said, yes, this sounds exciting. So that's
wow, that's
came
great.
About.
So this is really fascinating. So you're dealing with how men and women males and females, because
mm-hmm.
I presume it's boys and girls as well, not just adults.
No. I've only studied adults so far.
Only adults.
I think that there might be very interesting things to learn at the child level, too, but it would be a lot to try to mix all that data together, so someone would have to look at that separately.
Right. And how they interact with software.
Yes, that's right.
So tell us about that. I mean, what are some of the
uh-huh.
high-level findings?
Uh-huh. Well, so I've noticed some differences, and what we did is we started from the theory. So there's a lot of literature out there from different domains about how men and women problem solve and about differences in those problem-solving styles, differences in information gathering styles, differences, of course, in communication styles, differences in learning styles. So there's all this stuff out there. And so we started reading from those different fields, and as we were reading from those fields, we had this little thought right there in our heads saying, well, what does this tell us about software? And so as we were thinking about software while reading these other things, then all of these hypotheses just start dropping in our laps because there did seem to be very strong implications for the way people might use software.
Mm.
And so then we took those hypotheses into the lab. And as I said before I got here, I was working in the spreadsheet paradigm. And so we did a lot of studies studying that. And then I brought those same hypotheses with me here. Mm. So, for example, there are very well-known differences, gender differences. Oh, and I should mention, too, that all of these differences that I'm talking about are statistical, and they're on a lot of different sort of attributes of a person. So you would never find a person, say, for example, a female, who would actually fit that statistical profile. It's all a bunch of averages. And so by looking more closely at females and males, especially females, because they're the ones who seem to, you know, sort of be more at risk right now in the world of software, if we look closely at them and all this complicated set of attributes they have and notice sort of statistical trends, then what we can identify is ways that the software isn't necessarily a great match for a large segment of the population. And we can fix that. And if we fix it, then we're not only helping the fraction of females who helped us identify it in the first place, but also the males who fall into that same category on that particular attribute. Hmm. So it's not a matter of trying to come up with a female version or a male version of software, because that wouldn't fit anybody.
Right.
It's a matter of trying to find these things that seem to affect this segment and then saying, oh, I get it, we should do it this other way, and therefore take down the barrier. Mm-hmm. Okay, but that's not really answering what you asked, is it? So what you asked is, what did you notice? Okay. So there's this pervasive finding, for example, that females statistically tend to be more risk-averse than males. And, you know, I mean, this is good for the survival of the species, so we're probably glad that it's that way. But these results pervade across a number of different fields. I guess statistically females are more risk-averse in financial decision-making, in personal safety, in, you know, just about everywhere they study it. Females are more risk-averse than males. Okay, so if there is some feature in the environment that looks a bit intimidating, then that should predict different responses to that intimidating feature. And that's the sort of thing that we've seen in our studies. And that kind of thing gets exaggerated if you tend to have a lower sense of confidence about your ability to grapple with software in the first place. Now, there are females who do have this lower opinion of themselves in grappling with software and females who don't have that lower opinion. But statistically, they tend to be on the lower side on this confidence scale than males. So if you combine, you know, a sort of lower sense of confidence about your ability to grapple with complicated features and a high degree of risk averseness, then that should predict that the features that seem to be more complicated or advanced, they might be less willing to try unless there's a strong need to do that for what they're trying to do. And then, of course, everybody will overcome whatever they have to. But if it's sort of in that optional category where you have a choice, then the cost-benefit-risk ratio will be different for people who fall in that category. And so exactly that is what we've seen.
So what are a couple of those more intimidating features in Excel?
Well, okay, so most of our studies have not really been in Excel, although we have done some in them. But we've also experimented in our own research prototype so that we can manipulate the complicatedness of the features so that we can really get at these questions. Let's see here. We did do one study in Excel, though, actually, which I did this back home. Well, I didn't do it back home. One of my students, who was still my student at the time, actually did it up here. Microsoft funded that particular study because they were interested in it. And so in that one, there were some features on the audit toolbar that a lot of people don't use, and so we thought that they might regard those as being more advanced because, you know, they aren't just sort of right out there, or at least weren't in that version of Excel, and so, you know, would require a certain amount of learning and practice. And what we did is we divided those up into features that we taught and features we had not taught, and we made sure that the people in our study hadn't used those features before. And so then we were able to experiment with or to observe how often they use familiar features that everybody knows how to do, like edit formulas, versus fiddle around with some of these features that we had taught versus fiddle around with some of the features that we pointed out to them but did not teach. And so we found this this statistical trend for both the females and the males, where the females were more likely to stick with the familiar ones that they were previously familiar with, again, just statistically, and the males were more likely to experiment with the more tricky ones. But that wasn't always a good thing for the males either. So I don't want you to get the impression that all of these things that we're seeing are about males somehow being in a better position than the females. I mean, a lot of the things we've seen are that way. But there, one thing that we've seen that wouldn't have come to light if we hadn't studied gender differences was also some problems in the way, it has to do with tinkering and exploring. So it seems from our data as though the females, possibly they don't experiment and explore quite enough, although they do some. But when they do, they seem to get a lot of benefit out of it. So they have seemed, in our data, to be very good at it. And there are some details about that kind of exploring that I won't bother to go into, but anyway. And the males, it seemed like they did two kinds of exploring. They did the kind that works well, same as the females, and then they also did another kind where they allowed themselves to get distracted and sort of go off in left field and fool around with the things, and then that was tied to less comprehension of how the stuff in the environment worked and also less productive outcomes on the task we were having them do, which was to find spreadsheet errors. So there are some things that we've found that we think would be helpful to females, but there are also some things that we've found along those lines that would be helpful to males. And if we can find these things and add them as additional ways to get the thing done, then we're taking down things that are disadvantageous to one group or the other.
Excellent. Sort of goes, you know, it doesn't really matter what the gender is.
That's right.
But one question that we'd ask, and Ritzy and I have been covering this stuff from women for like 3 years now.
Uh-huh.
In terms of theory, mm-hmm. I mean, what if, you know, most software was actually conceived of, composed by, constructed by females?
Mm-hmm.
Would you think, in your assessment, that mm-hmm. there would be a difference in the, sort of the manifestation of features and software
uh-huh.
in general?
Yeah, I do. I think that in software development in particular, but probably in every walk of life, when people are creating something for other people to use, they follow their own intuition about, you know, what it should be like, what's easy to do, what's hard to do, what's useful, what's the right way of going about things. So, I mean, a person's intuition can't help but affect what it is you're making, especially if you have a lot of freedom and if the thing you're working with is really malleable, like source code,
mm-hmm.
then yeah. And so given all of these differences that we've seen in the theory about how, for example, how females process information statistically versus the way males do, then we might have seen differences along those lines in an information gathering kind of task.
Mm.
And the area I've been looking at is stuff that has to do with problem solving about software, like debugging formulas in spreadsheets or debugging source code if you're a professional developer. And so those kinds of tasks are hard, and they're problem solving, and they require a lot of information, and they require a lot of navigation and a lot of searching and all of those things. And so it's possible that they bring out differences that wouldn't be present when you're not having to work cognitively as hard,
mm-hmm.
Because it seems like you have to go at those things with a kind of a strategy in mind. You can't just look at absolutely everything. And so it may magnify differences that wouldn't be present at all in, for example, something, you know, more ordinary like browsing or doing chatting or that sort of thing.
Hmm.
Interesting.
So what is the hope in terms of this research and what the outcome would be when companies like Microsoft are developing software?
Mm-hmm. So my grand scheme was to change the world in 3 months, so that may have been just a little bit naive. but actually, as I said, I've been working in this area for about 5 years now and publishing, so you know the papers are out there. And what I was hoping is that I might be able to get inside the intuition of people here at Microsoft who are helping to shape products. So I've been doing some talks last week and this week to try to get the word out within Microsoft of the various things we've found. I have collaborators, of course, here inside Microsoft. And also, I used data that some of the people inside Microsoft gave me that they had previously collected mm-hmm. from other studies. So I was using, you know, their team's data instead of going off and collecting new stuff, because I thought they would be more familiar and more connected with that data and have more of a vision of what the implications on their particular product might be if I found things in their data.
So what part of the workflow does this affect? Is it like the information architecture of the way an application works? Is it the user design? Is it the development and the coding of it? Like where the mm-hmm. testing, like how does it touch everything, or where does it really have impact?
I think it could touch everything. Some of the things, we've been much more active in researching whether it's there or where it is than we have in trying to figure out how to fix it. But back in home in my lab, we have experimented with a couple of things, and those things are at the feature level. And so the feature level, I mean, the kinds of changes that we've experimented with are very small and could be done just at the UI level. But then there are other things that could potentially be a lot bigger. For example, one line of research we've been after is whether males and females are using different debugging strategies. And so that goes way deeper than features, certainly goes way deeper than features that exist right now, because strategies might not even have the right feature set in the software right now to support them.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that it could extend at every level, and yes, even at the information architecture level and at the software architecture level, there's a very good group at Carnegie Mellon, in fact, that makes exactly that argument that usability, in many senses of the word, actually has to start at the software architecture level in order to be able to be carried through to what the user sees.
Interesting. So what else have you found?
Okay, let's see. What else have we found? So we've seen differences in attitudes toward kind of advanced features in general. We also have seen different levels of interest in particular features. One of the things that seems to be, let's see, coming out right now is that the females seem to be more interested in getting information about strategies. So this is some work that I did before I got here. What we did is we did a study in which we just kind of videotaped males and females working together in pairs on debugging. And we found out that actually what both of them were talking about a lot more than the features in the environment were strategies about how to go about it. And we realized that a lot of the help systems that are available in software really don't have very much to say about strategies. They have a lot to say about features, but not so much on strategies. Mm-hmm. So we experimented with doing some little tiny video snippets, about 1 minute long, on strategy topics that integrated the talk of the features in there. But it was very small. And then we had equivalent hypertext, because not everybody learns the same way. And we put that in an environment, and we found that both the males and the females liked the system better. And so before it was in there, we had this big gap. The males liked the software a lot better. And after we put it in, everybody went up, but the females went up more. And so it didn't end up disadvantaging the males. There was still a bit of a gender gap. But I guess the two main points are, number one, it really helped with the gender gap in their attitudes toward the software, and some other good outcomes too. And the other is, it helped everybody. And so it's a way to identify ways to make the system just plain better that you wouldn't necessarily see.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of along the lines of like curb cuts, mm-hmm. you know, those holes in the curbs.
Mm-hmm.
So people probably never would have discovered that if all they ever looked at are people who don't have any trouble walking and getting around. But instead, they studied a particular population closely. I think it was probably people in wheelchairs. And they said, gee, you know, this is horrible. We need to do something. You know, let's try this curb cut thing. And sure enough, it helped people in wheelchairs. Mm-hmm. But it also helped people that are with walkers. And it helped people who were pushing baby carriages. And it helped people who were pushing bicycles. And people who were pushing big, heavy bales of hay on these dolly things. And people mm-hmm. who, you know, are dragging suitcases. And just pretty much everyone. And I don't think they would have come about if they hadn't looked at one population and said, look at this.
Hmm.
So anyway, so you can regard the gender work in software along the same lines.
So is software inherently sexist?
Well, I don't think so. Inherently sexist. No, I would say that software reflects the intuitions of the people who build it. And so if you have a long history of tradition in which software always kind of gets built by the same kind of people, then not only is it hard to change that history when you start having more diversity, well, it is, because you've kind of got this momentum going in that direction too. So it takes some you know, really shaking about of your head, I think, to realize, you know, oh, these boxes that I have built that are sort of established tradition, you know, in my head, they may not, maybe software doesn't have to be that way. So I guess I don't think it's sexist. I think it's like having a child, right? The child reflects the characteristics of the parent, so the software reflects the characteristics of the people who built it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Just that the most common case is that the parents are of the same gender.
That's right.
One of the things I've noticed in Windows 7 if you will. This is not marketing because we don't market on Channel 9. But I have noticed that Channel, at Windows 7, I would, no offense, I don't want to offend, but it's like, it does seem more feminine.
Mm-hmm.
And what I mean by that is it's much more efficient. Mm-hmm. Things get done quickly. You can figure out what you need to do fast. You can know what the problem is quickly. You don't have to write a bunch of scripts or code. Just mm-hmm. kind of, you don't have to be like a geek, who mm-hmm. the Uber geek is obviously a male.
Mm-hmm.
The what I wanted to ask, though, related to that, I'm not exactly sure why I just said what I said,
uh-huh.
but is in terms of the composition of software,
mm-hmm.
do you see different strategies that a female developer takes versus a male developer? I mean, I don't, in constructing algorithms?
Mm-hmm. I don't know. We haven't studied constructing algorithms. We have studied mostly debugging and crafting small portions of code according to specifications, but we haven't seen sort of sitting down, you know, and saying, you know, what should the algorithm be like? So they might be there. But in terms of working within a software environment and working with code and that sort of thing, we do see strategy differences. The spreadsheet paradigm is the one that we've done the most study of that in. And in that one, those were end users trying to debug spreadsheets, spreadsheet formulas, and so we asked them at the end, what were your strategies, and then we categorized everything they said,
mm-hmm.
and we came out with 8 strategies that these end users talked about, and we actually had gender differences in 7 of them.
Wow.
So, yeah.
So men and women are different?
No. Well, I think every individual is different,
right.
But they do tend to line up statistically on some characteristics, so, yeah. So if you take, you know, any 2 females, you know, they might be alike in more characteristics than the man next door to them would be, but they'll be different in some characteristics, too.
Hmm. So what else?
What else? Let's see. What else about gender? Can I talk about some of my other stuff, too?
I would love it.
Okay.
This isn't just about software.
Okay. Let's see here. So also one of the things that's been a big area for me is what we call end-user software engineering,
mm.
which is a sort of an end-user programming grows-up kind of thing. So end-user programming is about people who are actually creating their own software who aren't trained in doing that. And, you know, a classic example is, of course, spreadsheets. Because every time you're putting a formula into a spreadsheet, you're actually teaching the computer how to behave
yep.
in the future. So what end-user software engineering is about is, well, what about the rest of the software lifecycle? I mean, what happens after they get past that create stage? What about debugging and testing and making design decisions and a lot of the other things that actually come up for these end-user programmers? So I'm collaborating with a group of really wonderful people on that, and we have been for 5 or 6 years now. And so this is a collaboration that spreads across the country. So there are 6 or I guess we're up to 8 or 9 different institutions working together on this in a collaboration, and then it's actually a whole field now, and there are other people not in our collaboration that are working on it too.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a big deal for us.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm especially excited about it because there are roughly an order of magnitude more end-user programmers out there already than there are professional programmers. So this affects a huge number of people,
mm-hmm.
and it's all about sort of empowerment and being able to trust what you build once you have this empowerment.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, so anybody who's listening who's saying, gee, what would I like to work on if I were in computer science, work on that, because it's cool.
Sure, and there's probably like a gender balance in that area compared to like professional developers.
Actually, yes. I think something like 50% of the developers of spreadsheets are females. And furthermore, the research area, mm-hmm. tends to attract as many females as males. So I know in our collaboration we're roughly 50-50.
Nice.
It's a nice blend of people who do software engineering research and people who do human-computer interaction research and people who do programming language research. And
mm.
we have a couple of psychologists and a person who researches education, and all of those folks are involved in it.
It feels overwhelming to me, meaning like you've been working on this for 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
These are some of the things that you found.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, yes, you have some solid recommendations on what we could do to make it more balanced for
mm-hmm.
both genders. But like, how do we really change, you know, high tech and software development when it is done mostly by males and continues to be so, even though that gap is closing?
Mm-hmm.
And also the kind of person, even if it's a
mm-hmm.
man or a woman, it's
mm-hmm.
that, you know, highly technical, mathematical
mm-hmm.
kind of, you know, left brain thinker.
Mm-hmm.
How do we really like make a shift.
Uh-huh. Well, I think there's been a lot of progress in that area over the years anyway. So it isn't as though, you know, the ground has been solid and not moving. So things are moving in the right direction, but still it's quite an uphill battle because it's been hard to attract people who are underrepresented in computer science now into it. That problem is a very big problem and not one I'm an expert on, but I can tell you an organization that is, which actually Microsoft supports in a big way too, and that's the National Center for Women in Technology. So that's abbreviated NCWIT, and anybody who's interested in knowing more about that problem, this is a great organization that's been collecting data from all the different people who are working on that problem and all the different people who have tried things and can contribute expertise, and they're putting that all together into best practices and even kits so that educators and people in the workforce and people at the K-12 level, that all those people can start building on each other's shoulders in a good way. So that's to try to attract more women and minorities into computer science to get more diversity in. But I know that a lot of companies are also actively seeking to staff up in those areas anyway. And so I know that they recruit heavily, and there are special scholarships for women and minorities to go into computer science. And companies are working very hard to try to get more diversity in software teams for exactly the reasons that you just pointed out, because they see it also as being important. I mean, if they're going to sell software to diverse audiences, then obviously they want diverse people on their creation teams to get lots of different thinking to bear on the problem.
Interesting.
So,
I mean, that's a big problem in general, just getting, you know, just getting people, regardless of their gender, into computer science. I mean, if you think about it, if you look at technical curriculum, there's a lot of women who major in chemistry. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of women who major in biology and mathematics.
Uh-huh.
So
that's
the
true.
Mathematics argument doesn't really work.
Exactly.
It's a computer science problem.
Exactly.
That's right. I mean, that's what we need to figure out. Mm-hmm. I don't think anybody has. I mean, I haven't read the papers from the organization.
That organization is really great. I'm really glad you brought up this problem, too. The fact that it's not, that it does seem to be particular to computer science, not generic to problem-solving fields or detailed fields or anything like that. And there are, in fact, some graphs that show all the engineering fields going up in terms of participation by females and computer science still going down. So it's a complicated problem with a lot of different factors, and that's what makes this organization cool, is because they're kind of a clearinghouse to bring together data on all those different factors, not just, you know, the one that a particular person might have in mind. And I think maybe before they came along, that was kind of one of the problems, is that it was easy to identify one factor that could be contributing to it, and so some professor could do that and then try to change it in their classroom, and then it wouldn't work, and so they'd give up. And the problem is, you know, when you have something that has a lot of different factors and you only change one of them, it tends not to be enough, and so then people would get discouraged. Mm-hmm. So this organization helps everybody understand all the different things at work and recommend some good ideas for change. So that's the way to go, is to go there and look at their best practices and try those.
Excellent. We will do that.
Are there any other companies out there other than Microsoft that are really investing in this area and doing a good job? Like, I'm thinking of Apple. I'm thinking.
Well, so I'm not an expert on NCWIT, so I guess you'd probably have to go to their page. Mm-hmm. But I know that it's a priority for a lot of different companies, and a lot of different companies are sponsoring NCWIT. And I know that that Intel is throwing something there, and I know Google has scholarships for women. They're probably supporting this organization too, and a lot of smaller companies, and the National Science Foundation has been a major supporter of it. And so there, you know, there are a lot of different resources going into this organization and this problem.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
it's a very interesting problem.
Mm-hmm.
So, but you haven't told us something yet. And we always ask this to all of our guests,
mm-hmm.
and that is, why aren't there more women writing code? Why aren't there more women designing operating systems? Why aren't there more women writing network infrastructure? What's going on here? I mean, just what's your opinion?
It's probably not something I'm an expert on. This is something you have to look at NCWIT for, I think. But one thing that I've noticed in my studies is it seems like the attitude that men and women have toward technology seems to be a little bit different. It seems to me that a lot of women go into computer science for the same reason I did. And I went into it for the joy of creation and the joy of problem solving. That's what I really like. And I think that a lot of men like that, too. I mean, I'm not trying to say they don't. But it seems like they have another reason, too, which is a lot of the males are sort of into technology as a toy. And I haven't seen as much of that for the females. But anyway,
Well, males like to talk loud in hallways and carry on banter for a long time. So I hope everybody heard you, but we'll wait until the dudes are done communicating. But that's interesting. I just think there has to be something. For example, in your world, how many female students do you have that are getting PhDs or advanced degrees?
That's an interesting question. So at the undergrad level, the female participation is very, very low. But interestingly, it seems like a fairly high proportion of those move on. Mm-hmm. And so it's probably that there is a pretty severe selection process due to a number of factors that goes on at the undergrad level. And once they make it through that, they're more likely to keep going on. So I personally have something like half female and half male students on my team, but of course I'm a female, so I attract them. But even in our graduate program in computer science, I think we have something like 20 or 25% females, whereas at the undergrad program, it's much lower than that. Mm. So,
are there any other female comp sci professors at Oregon State?
Yes. Let's see here. So in computer science, we have two others, and we're actually a merged department with electrical engineering. And over there they have, one, two, three at least. Yeah, so that would be six, unless I've lost count. Maybe there's somebody I forgot, but yeah.
There are a few.
Yeah.
But in the minority.
In the minority, yeah. And I guess there are probably more now than there were originally. So back when I was getting my degrees, it was pretty unusual to see even one in a department. And I'm the second female to have gotten my PhD from the university I graduated from in computer science. So, it was a little rarer then. Yeah.
So here's an interesting idea for a research project, and you guys can take credit for it. I'm just kidding. Have you ever done any research where you have a problem, right? You have to write an algorithm to solve a very simple problem. You have to write an app, some sort of app, and this isn't a spreadsheet app, but it's some sort of app.
Mm-hmm.
And you divide up the teams into males,
mm-hmm.
and make sure on the male you have the sort of aggressive the dude who's the hacker, the smarter than everybody else, because males really tend to like to prove that they're smarter than the other males that they're around. And then do the same with women, and if you can find a woman that's also like that, that would also be cool. But just, it would be interesting to see, A, what's the difference in the user design? So all you do is give them a problem to solve, and you have to write a simple application to solve it with a UI.
Uh-huh.
It would be interesting to see what the women come up with.
Mm-hmm.
And they own the algorithms, they own the IE, they own the user experience, and the actual implementation of everything.
Uh-huh.
Same for the dudes.
Mm-hmm.
I'd love to see the differences. Mm-hmm. And then that would be a wonderful thing to look at and go,
You know, I think there's work out there that has done that, because I'm not the only one who's looked at things that sort of relate to software and females. And so, for example, there are people who have looked at programming environments for males and females. There's some great work that's right now housed at Washington University in St. Louis by Caitlin Kelleher, and that's been an area of interest for her. And then there have been lots of emerging environments for children. Actually, I think there's one here at MSR, and there's one at MIT, and one out of Colorado, and several other places.
Mm-hmm.
And there, too, I know that they've paid a lot of attention to the kinds of software that the males build and the females build. I know that one thing that they've found is a lot of these environments are sort of ways to build games or simulations or things like that. And so the males tend to build sort of, you know, male-style shoot-em-up games, and the females tend to build more kind of simulation things, you know, so storytelling things. And so there's this whole environment that came out of this. This is Caitlin Kelleher's PhD thesis. She calls it Storytelling Alice, and so that's a particular environment to facilitate storytelling kind of applications as a way to attract middle school girls into computer science.
Mm-hmm.
And she's had very good results with that.
Cool.
So, yeah, so definitely I'm not the only one.
I mean, we should probably do that here at Microsoft, right? Mm-hmm. We should let, I mean, again, coming back to Windows 7, it's absolutely clear that Julie Larson Green and company own the user experience for Windows 7. I mean, it's just, it's clear to me. Versus in the olden days, which was just Vista or even before, where you had, obviously this was designed purely by engineers, and, and you had to dig deep to figure out what the problems were from a user experience. That's why I mentioned just user experience. Like, so anyway, it's interesting. And this is a great way to almost end the Women in Technology series, because there's no more women at Microsoft. We've done it all, man. We have no one else to talk to.
Oh, that can't be true.
What a great way to end it.
That can't be true. So what's your next sabbatical in 7 years?
Oh my goodness. I have no idea, but I guess I should start thinking about it right now, because the anticipation is half the fun, weighing all the choices and the options and the things you could do. Yeah.
But this is something that you've been doing for, studying for 5 years, right?
Yes, this, at least, I mean, 5 years.
How long will this continue on? Like, when do you move on to the next topic?
Good question. So let's see here. It was the PhD topic of Laura Beckwith, who was my first PhD student in this area. And then another one of my students is working on this right now and will be joining Microsoft very soon, in fact. So that's Valentina Grigorianu. And then I have another student who's working on it, and she's far from graduating. So, you know, obviously it's going to keep going for another 2 or 3 years at least. And, I mean, it's the sort of thing that could go on a long time, because I think there's a lot to look at, and it's you know, it hasn't been all that common for people to look at this issue. So, yeah, so I'm still on a roll with this one, and the end-user software engineering and some other things that I'm working on. And this actually kind of dovetails nicely with the end-user software engineering, too, because most of the populations we look at are actually end-users. It was just here at Microsoft that I looked at the professional developer population, too. But, yeah, it's kind of more interesting to look at it from the end-user programmer's perspective, because there they have less influences on what their strategies ought to be, because they haven't been trained in debugging and that sort of thing. So you have a less, quote, tainted population with what they ought to be doing and going about it, and that might give us a clearer vision of maybe what would be a better fit for them.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And so what do you think of, like, you've spent, I mean, obviously, we invest a lot in research here at Microsoft World, and for good reason. What do you make of your experience here in building that?
Yeah, what's been the reception?
Oh, yeah, it's been great. I've really enjoyed being here, and there's been a lot of interest in the topic, too. So I knew I was only going to be here for the 3 months, and so I came in advance and gave a talk, and I was trying to get people from product teams interested enough to give me data. And so they did. You know, a lot of people came to my talk and volunteered data, and some of it panned out and some of it didn't, and then they introduced me to more people. And and so I've been having meetings with people all across campus ever since I got here, and ended up with more data than I could actually use in many cases, and opportunities for even more. But we had our hearts set on particular ones, you know, as we saw how everything was kind of lining up. And then there's been a lot of interest in the topic. So, you know, this last 10 days, I'm sort of losing count, something along the lines of 5 or 6 talks on it, to try to spread the word around. And people have been very receptive, and, I've gotten a lot of invitations, and so it's been super, and it's been an exciting place, too. Lots of ideas kind of bouncing off the walls all over the place, so it's been a very good experience, and I've had a lot of fun.
Great.
Awesome.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for sharing this, and this will definitely help get the word out when we post this on Channel 9.
Fantastic.
So thank you. Keep up the great work.
Okay, cool. Thanks.
Thanks. Did we miss anything?
I think that's it.
All right. Nothing crazy this time.
Cheers. Thank heavens. Yeah.